This is day five of this October 2015 7-day session. And we will resume reading from the teachings of 12th century Korean Zen master Chinu. And this is from the book The Collected Works of Chinu, translated by Robert Buswell. This little section is called The Nescience of the True Mind. Nescience means the absence of knowledge. I had to look it up when I first did this text, and I think I'm just going to, it's just such a dry, abstract word, I'm just going to use the word not knowing. Question: when the true mind and the deluded mind are involved with the sense spheres, how can we distinguish the true from the deluded? Chinu: when the deluded mind is in contact with the sense spheres, of course this means sights and sounds, smells and so forth, it knows through a discriminative awareness. It gives rise to greedy or hateful states of mind, depending on whether pleasant or unpleasant objects are present, or else it gives rise to ignorant states of mind when neutral objects are encountered. Since the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion are produced because of these objects, it is easy to see that the mind is deluded. This is a nice, clear outline of these three, the three poisons. Usually, in most texts, the first one is greed or avarice, and in many, there are many forms of that, some subtle and some gross. The second is variously translated as anger, hatred, ill will, enmity, and also that. In that, there are many forms of that, some more subtle than others. And the third is delusion. So he's saying that when we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think, then this gives rise to either the greedy or the hateful, that is the liking or disliking, basically, or the neutral. And he quotes the Sun Zan, the author of Affirming Faith and Mind: to founder in dislike and like is nothing but the mind's disease. And he says, consequently, we know that it is the deluded mind which sustains the dichotomy between right and wrong, liking and disliking. And then he contrasts this with true mind. As far as true mind is concerned, it knows while knowing nothing. But because it is impartial, quiet, and utterly radiant, it is different from the not knowing of grass and trees. Since it does not give rise to feelings of hatred or lust, it is different from the deluded mind. The true mind, when in contact with the sense spheres, is empty and yet bright, neither hateful nor greedy, not knowing and yet aware. This distinction is one that we all come to eventually if we stick with this long enough, the difference between awareness and knowing. That is, when we are in a state of truly not knowing, that we can be fully aware, more aware than when we have trafficking in thoughts and concepts. We're aware because we're open in this state of not knowing. When we're caught in thoughts, we're really kind of enveloped in the noise in our mind, and we are out of touch to some degree or another with things around us, or even what's going on in our own mind. We're unaware of what's inside and what's outside to some degree, one or the other. You see this sometimes in public when someone might be completely lost in thought. My experience of this is older people who just get caught somewhere and blocking traffic or something, and they just lose awareness of what's going on. Whereas in absorption in our practice, there is this keen awareness. Although there isn't necessarily that's not necessarily true, because in some states of deep concentration, we can also lose touch with things around us, what's going on. I've often quoted this text from ancient China, where the master says, "One who is working on Mu does not see the sky when he raises his head, nor the ground when he lowers his head." This is a temporary state. It's a state of approaching critical mass, where one is so consumed by the koan that one temporarily loses awareness of things around you. But if one were then to persist in even ever more deepening concentration, then one breaks through that into a world of vibrant awareness of everything. I said it earlier in Sesshin, we don't really need to know what we're doing, whatever that means. We don't have to have a map in Zen practice, in Sesshin, in Zazen. We don't have to have our spatial coordinates. All we need is to hold fast to the practice, the breath or the koan, and then we will find our way. In fact, it requires to really find our way, to find the way, the Tao, requires that we let go of our what we think we know, let go of space, let go of time, just hurtle into this darkness of not knowing. There's a little verse by Dogen. "Coming, going, the waterfowl leave no trace, nor do they need a guide." This isn't just understood in Zen. It's in other mystical traditions. We hear it in the words of St. John of the Cross, in his work, The Dark Night of the Soul. He says, if one wishes to be sure of the road he treads on, he must close his eyes and walk in the dark. Roshi Kaplan used to say that in the monasteries in Japan, he would hear, he must become a mu idiot, a mu simpleton. Recently, I was watching some of the U.S. Open tennis tournament, and there was a spectacular upset where a Kevin Anderson from South Africa beat the much, much higher ranked Andy Murray in one of the late matches in the now quarterfinals or semifinals. And then when he was interviewed afterward, he was talking about how he's taken him a while, but in fact years and years of falling short of the later rounds in these tournaments, and how he's finally learned that he has to keep it simple. And the more he can avoid thinking and just trust his body awareness to respond, the better he plays. And this is a direct quote from the New York Times article of his words. I use the expression, dumb yourself down a little bit. When you're out there, the less you can think, the better. This is the not knowing that Chinua was talking about. It's the great privilege of being in Sesshin is we don't have to concern ourselves with much of anything at all. And once we learn the schedule, we learn what the bells and the blocks mean, then we can just move from one thing to the other, and without, especially without the burden of decision making, and that's based on our preferences, just give it all up. Give it all up and trust that the practice we're working on will handle everything just fine. I'm going to shift to another chapter now in this book. The chapter is called Secrets on Cultivating the Mind. Question. You talked about seeing into our true nature, but when there is true seeing of the nature, the person becomes enlightened and should be able to perform magic and miracles. He would be different from other people. How is it then that among those who cultivate the mind nowadays, not one can display these spiritual powers? Well, you know basically what Chino is going to say. Chino, you should not utter absurdities lightly. To be unable to differentiate the perverse from the noble is to be deluded and confused. Of course, he's comparing these so-called magic and miracles to the perverse, compared to the nobility of this no mind, this freedom from thought. He continues, nowadays you people who are training on the path chat about truth with your mouth, but in your minds you only shrink from it and end up falling into the error of underestimating yourselves by thinking that you do not share in the Buddha nature. This is all that you are doubting. You train on the path but do not know the proper sequence of practice. You talk about truth but do not distinguish the root from the branches. This is called wrong view. It is not called true practice. You are only deceiving yourselves. You are deceiving others too. How can you not be on your guard against this? I may be wrong, but I think Chinul was dealing with a lot more people who were not serious about their practice, who spent a lot of time gossiping and who are preoccupied with things peripheral to true practice. Certainly in Sesshin, in silence, the silence of Sesshin, you can't level these same charges. Anyone who sits through 7-day Sesshin is not the people he's addressing. You talk about truth but do not distinguish the root from the branches. Just by coming to Sesshin, you've distinguished the root from the branches, chosen the root. But there's one thing here. You chat about truth with your mouth, but in your minds you only shrink from it and end up falling into the error and so forth. I think there's something deeply human about shrinking from the realm of no thought. And by that I mean shrinking from the void. Shrinking from the absence of thought. Why else would we so desperately cling to our thoughts? Even though we know they're working against us, and yet it takes so long for most of us to learn that they just bedevil our lives, these thoughts. And yet we tend to hang on for dear life to these thoughts. It's just amazing, really. When we see how much unnecessary suffering we cause ourselves by insisting on playing with our thoughts. I'm convinced that there is a fear, a shrinking from this pure absence of thought. What seems to be somehow threatening, I guess. This so-called void is our salvation. It will deliver us from the tyranny of our thoughts. And I think for most of us, it just takes a while. We have to keep going back into the practice. That's our way into this realm of no thought. We have to keep going back into the practice again and again, hundreds, thousands of times, before we start to relax into that, and then we can follow it on beyond this ordinary mind and its discriminations. It's so ironic. The very thing, the very direction we need to go is what we continue to avoid. We run from the void. (Clears throat) Now, there are many approaches to the path, but essentially they are included in the twofold approach of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation. Although sudden awakening, sudden cultivation, has been advocated, this is the entrance for people of the highest faculties. If you were to probe their pasts, you would see that their cultivation has been based for many lives on the insights gained in a previous awakening. Now, in this life, after gradual permeation, these people hear the Dharma and awaken. In one instant, their practice is brought to a sudden conclusion. I think of the story of the young Japanese woman that Harada Roshi talks about in The Three Pillars, who came to awakening when she came to an introductory talk by him on Zen. And in that talk, he drew a circle, the Enso, Zen circle, on a blackboard. And with that, she came to Kensho. This is someone who's done a lot of practice in the past. And more than that, has it would seem, has awakened in the past. So she was just poised. She was like a ripe peach just ready to drop when she came to that introduction. But this is very rare. And he says, but if we try to explain this according to the facts, then sudden awakening, sudden cultivation, this is the case of like this woman, is also the result of an initial awakening and its subsequent cultivation. So presumably in a past life, she had the awakening, but then she went on to deepen it over years or maybe lifetimes. Consequently, this twofold approach of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation is the track followed by thousands of sages. Hence, of all the sages of old, there were none who did not first have an awakening, subsequently cultivate it, and finally, because of their cultivation, gain realization. Notice here, he's distinguishing between first the awakening, and then, after long practice, then realization. So the difference between an initial tiny insight into one's true nature and then the true realization is something altogether different. He continues to address this questioner. The so-called magic and miracles you mentioned manifest because of the gradual permeation of cultivation practice based on an initial awakening. It should not be said that they appear simultaneously with that awakening. As it is said in the sutras, the noumenon is awakened to suddenly. And noumenon, and there's another one of these very abstract words, which means, basically it means the original mind, the undifferentiated mind, the undivided mind. The noumenon is awakened to suddenly and is forged in accordance with this awakening. Phenomena cannot be removed suddenly. They are brought to an end step by step. Brought to an end. Of course, there's no literal end to phenomena. That's the world. Phenomena is the world that we live in. But brought to an end means seen through, pulled free of the bondage of this saha world. For this reason, Kuei Feng, in a profound explanation of the meaning of initial awakening, subsequent cultivation, said, I have a star in the margin by this, although we know that a frozen pond is entirely water, the sun's heat is necessary to melt it. Although we awaken to the fact that an ordinary person is Buddha, the power of Dharma is necessary to make it permeate our cultivation. When that pond has melted, the water flows freely and can be used for irrigation and cleaning. When falsity is extinguished, the mind will be numinous and dynamic, and then its function of penetrating brightness will manifest. So the emphasis on post-kensho practice, in order to really be able to have this insight, this initial insight, function freely in our lives, work for us. I love this emphasis, his use of the word like irrigation and cleaning. It's the practical, workable nature of awakening and practice. That Zen is so characteristic of Zen. Zen is so down to earth. How can you use it? How can you use practice? How can you use awakening to serve others? Question. You have said that this twofold approach of sudden awakening and gradual cultivation is the track followed by thousands of sages. But if awakening is really sudden awakening, what need is there for gradual cultivation? And if cultivation means gradual cultivation, how can you speak of sudden awakening? Chinul, first let us take sudden awakening. When the ordinary person is deluded, he assumes that the four great elements are his body and the false thoughts are his mind. In other words, he doesn't really see beyond a materialistic perspective. The body is just these material elements and thinks that there's nothing beyond thoughts, basically. He does not know that his own nature is the true Dharma body. He does not know that his own numinous awareness is the true Buddha, Buddha nature. He looks for Buddha nature outside his mind. While he is thus wandering aimlessly, the entrance to the road might by chance be pointed out by a wise advisor, teacher. If in one thought he then follows back the light of his mind to its source and sees his own original nature, he will discover that the ground of this nature is innately free of defilement and that he himself is originally endowed with the wisdom nature, which is not a hair's breadth different from that of all the enlightened ones. Hence it is called sudden awakening. When he says this, he looks for Buddha nature outside his mind. I suppose there would be people who would say, well, wait a minute, I'm meditating. I'm sitting still, my eyes just half closed, a gaze lowered, looking into my mind. What do you mean, looking for my Buddha nature outside the mind? But our thoughts... our thoughts become as though apart from us. As long as we are playing with our thoughts, then we are, in a sense, looking outside. We're looking to objects, thought objects. It's only when we turn away from thoughts and look into this source that we call mu, or breath, or other practices, looking into the source, that we are really looking into the mind and not looking outside the mind. Next, let us consider gradual cultivation, meaning, of course, practice after awakening. although he has awakened to the fact that his original, let's make it woman, a female, although she has awakened to the fact that her original nature is no different from that of the enlightened ones, the beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly, and so she must continue to cultivate practice while relying on this awakening. Through this gradual permeation, her endeavors reach completion. She constantly nurtures the sacred embryo, and after a long time, she becomes a sage. Hence, it is called gradual cultivation. There's a footnote here for this nurture the sacred embryo. Maybe it's self-evident to some people, but it's very short. I'll read it. This is the footnote. Sacred embryo refers to the practitioner during the three stages of worthiness. In Zen texts, the phrase constantly nurture the sacred embryo refers to subsequent cultivation after the initial awakening, during which the inchoate embryo of enlightenment is nurtured until finally the fetus matures and is born into the family of the Buddhas. And then back to Chino. This process can be compared to the maturation of a child. From the day of its birth, a baby is endowed with all the sense organs, just like everyone else, but its strength is not yet fully developed. It is only after many months and years that it will finally become an adult. Wonderful analogy. So, after awakening, we have to grow into it. We've seen into the formlessness of form, with the illusory nature of self and other and us and them and all the ways that we divide through words, the way we divide the world. We've seen through that, past it, underneath it, to this fundamental unity of all things. And yet, because of our habits, and the physical habits are the least of it, it's our mental habits. Because of that, it takes a while, a long time, to grow into what we've seen. This world of no self. There's a phrase I ran across not long ago from a Japanese Soto teacher for some previous century. To melt the frozen block of emotion thought. This really gets at the work ahead of us. The frozen block of emotion thought. The emotions and thoughts are so often all enmeshed. For example, with depression. Depression may have physiological or hormonal causes, but then in our ruminating and thinking about ourselves and our condition, we bind ourselves. It's through the thoughts that we bind ourselves to the emotion. Same with anger. There's the initial uprush of anger or irritation, and that in itself is no big deal. That would just pass if we didn't bind ourselves to it with thoughts. Thoughts about that person or those people, or that's what sticks us to the emotion and makes it so hard to just let the emotion just run its course, which it will do if we don't delay it with our thoughts. This is a correct understanding of how emotions fit into practice. We're human beings. We have emotions. They arise and they pass. If we give them half a chance to pass, rather than dwelling in our minds, dwelling on the circumstances, the people involved with that emotion. Question: when the superior person hears Dharma, he understands easily. Average and inferior people, however, have doubt and confusion. Could you describe some methods so that the deluded, too, can enter into enlightenment? Chinu: the path is not related to knowing or not knowing. You should get rid of the mind which clings to its delusion and looks forward to enlightenment, and listen to me. Notice that. Get rid of the mind which looks forward to enlightenment. This is so important. So many people, especially people who come to Sesshin, spend too much time looking forward to enlightenment. They're sitting and sort of concentrating on their practice, but then in the back of their mind, they're looking ahead. This is an obstruction that we have to get through. And we get through it, of course, by being completely absorbed in our practice. Without doing it halfway or three quarters, and then with the rest of our mind looking ahead to what might be coming. So ironic that people who have a strong aspiration and want to awaken for the sake of all beings then have to give that up as far as a thought. They have to renounce that thought, not the aspiration. Their aspiration is a wonderful thing. Their aspiration is something that, who knows how often, how many lifetimes we've been without that aspiration. But we don't have to worry about holding on to it. This is the Buddha seed. This is we can't lose, ultimately. We just have to avoid thinking about getting somewhere. Chinua continues, since all dharmas when it's plural means things, phenomena, since all phenomena are like dreams or phantoms, deluded thoughts are originally calm and the sense spheres are originally void. At the point where all dharmas are void, the numinous awareness is not obscured. That is to say, this mind of void and calm, numinous awareness is your original face. It is also the Dharma seal transmitted without a break by all the enlightened ones of the three time periods, the successive generations of ancestors and the teachers of this world. Well, there's another question that opens up another segment. So let's stop now and recite the four vows.